podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It's Monday, November 26th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us here at Normal. Help us end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org to make your donation or join Normal today. I hope everyone had a very safe and fun long holiday and holiday weekend there. I know we're still working through the leftovers on this Monday after Thanksgiving. Got a great audio stash for you today. We're going to revisit some audio I recorded last year at the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference. That conference was in Washington, D.C. last year. SSDP is having their conference in concert with the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in New Orleans next week. We're going to play some audio from the Drug Policy Alliance director, Ethan Nadelman, here on the podcast this week. Some speeches that he's given around the country. As we lead into the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in New Orleans, again, it starts next week on December 5th. More information is available at drugpolicy.org and ssdp.org as well. So today on the program, we're going to hear a really interesting panel. We played a portion of this last year when we originally recorded it. We're going to play a longer portion today. This panel featured journalist Ryan Grimm. He works for Politico.com now. Ryan appeared here with an interview on the audio stash around a piece he wrote for Slate.com when he was employed at Slate. He covered a lot of prohibition topics there and continues to do some great work there for Politico.com. Also on this panel is radio personality and syndicated columnist Bill Press. And speaking of syndicated columnists, also on the panel is Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, of course, has been here on the program as well. Very outspoken individual when it comes to prohibition policy in the United States. So this panel today with Ryan Grimm, Bill Press, Clarence Page, recorded at the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference last year in Washington, D.C. That's going to be our feature content today, and we've got daily news to start things off. You can download a number of speeches from the SSDP conference last year. They're on the Normal Events podcast, along with a lot of 2007 Normal conference audio. Oh, and by the way, folks, Normal's webmasters, Red Aphid Interactive Media, they've been working really hard on getting a lot of the Normal 2007 conference video available online. We'll have links directly to that content right up at normalaudiostash.com today. And there's going to be new video coming online, well, pretty much every week here in the future. So we've got a big stash for you today. Let's get things started with our daily news. Our news today comes from the Normal News Weekly press release from Washington, D.C. Decriminalizing pot will reduce prison population, have no adverse impact on public safety, study says. Decriminalizing so-called victimless crimes, particularly those related to drug use, can reduce the U.S. prison population without adversely affecting public safety, According to the findings of a study published this week by the JFA Institute, a Washington, D.C. criminal justice think tank. Quote, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, approximately 30-40% of all current prison admissions involve crimes that have no direct or obvious victim other than the perpetrator, close quote, the report finds. It continues, quote, the drug category constitutes the largest offense category, with 31% of all prison admissions resulting from such crimes, close quote. Previous data released last year by the Bureau of Justice Statistics indicates that 12.7% of state inmates and 12.4% of federal inmates incarcerated for drug violations are serving time for marijuana offenses. The report states, quote, violence that surrounds drug trafficking in the United States is largely absent, close quote, in Western European countries that have liberalized their drug possession policies. The authors further note that the decriminalization of drugs, particularly marijuana, in regions that have enacted such reforms has not been associated with an increase in crime rates. The report speculates that decriminalizing illicit drugs, along with enacting modest reforms in sentencing and parole, would save taxpayers an estimated $20 billion per year and reduce the prison population from 1.5 million to below 700,000. Currently, more than 1.5 million Americans are serving time in state and federal prisons, up from fewer than 200,000 in 1970. Another 750,000 Americans are incarcerated in local jails. Yet despite this increase in incarceration, the U.S. crime rate today is approximately the same as it was in the early 1970s, when the prison boom began. A previous JFA report commissioned for the Normal Foundation in 2005 concluded that depenalizing minor marijuana possession offenses would not increase marijuana use and would enable law enforcement to reallocate criminal justice resources towards addressing more serious crimes. More information is available about this story at normal.org. We have links to the full study, Unlocking America, Why and How to Reduce America's Prison Population, on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal's Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. Next up today is a longer presentation of audio we recorded last year at the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference. This panel features journalists Ryan Grimm, who now works at Politico.com, who at the time was working at Slate.com, also Bill Press, nationally syndicated radio personality and columnist, and syndicated columnist Clarence Page. Again, this is at the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference last year in Washington, D.C. The SSDP conference is taking place next week, along with the DPA conference in New Orleans. More information about that is available at drugpolicy.org and ssdp.org. We have links to both on our website today. You can also download this complete panel with Ryan Grimm, Clarence Page, and Bill Press at the Normal Events Podcast. We have links to that on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. I am extremely excited about this panel. This is such an important issue for us to be discussing here at this conference, and I think amongst the drug policy community in general. You know, the public at large get their views on this issue, on the drug issue and the drug policy issue, from the mainstream media. You know, all of you in this room, or most of you in this room, are probably subscribed to things like the Drug War Chronicle or Normal's newsletter, MPP news alerts, or the SSDP newsletter, that kind of thing. Those kind of alerts and newsletters. But the reality is the mainstream public, they're not subscribed to our publications, and they're not getting the news that we put out there, and they're generally not getting their views from drug policy reform organizations, as hard as we may try. The way that the major media covers this issue truly shapes the way that not only the public perceives this issue, but also the way that lawmakers perceive this issue. And it's critical that the issue is portrayed in a fair an accurate manner in the mainstream press if we are ever going to make any progress towards reforming these drug laws. You know, how many times have you read a story about, a marijuana policy reform effort, a serious reform effort, a ballot initiative, and heard cute little double entendres like Nevada's up in smoke, or, you know, initiative gone to pot, or those kind of things that really show a lack of seriousness about this issue in the mainstream press? How many times have you all heard the term drug-related crime? Have you all heard the term drug-related crime? How many of you in the mainstream press have heard the term prohibition-related crime? Pretty much never, exactly. So it's really, really important for us as a drug reform community to have a discussion with members of the mainstream media about what we can do to have our issue portrayed more positively in the mainstream press. And so it's very important for folks like Clarence Page and Bill Press and Ryan Grimm to come here today to talk about, you know, what are some of the things that we as reformers do to hurt the way that our cause is covered in the mainstream press? And what are some things that we as reformers can do to more positively influence the way that this issue is covered in the press? You know, what biases do some of our panelists see in their colleagues when they cover this issue? How much of the coverage is dictated by the editors or the bosses, and not so much the writers themselves? How many of these cute little headlines are put in there by editors when the reporters are actually trying to portray this issue seriously? So this is an incredibly important discussion, and it's one that I think is very much overdue, not just for Students for Sensible Drug Policy, but for the drug policy reform community as a whole. And with that, I'd like to introduce our panel today. We have Bill Press. He is an on-air political analyst for MSNBC. He's the former co-host of MSNBC's Buchanan Impressed and CNN's Crossfire. He's authored several books, including Spin This and Bush Must Go, Top 10 Reasons Why George W. Bush Doesn't Deserve a Second Term.
See how well that worked, huh?
Mr. Press is also a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist whose weekly column is distributed by Tribune Media Services to newspapers across the country, and he also hosts the Bill Press Show on Sirius Satellite Radio. Clarence Page is a journalist, syndicated columnist, and member of the editorial board for the Chicago Tribune. He's an occasional panelist on the McLaughlin Group, a regular contributor of essays to the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He's host of several documentaries on the Public Broadcasting Service and an occasional commentator on National Public Radio's Weekend Edition. Page often appears as a political analyst on The Chris Matthews Show. He's also appeared in The Rising Sun, the movie Rising Sun, playing himself as a talk show panel member. Page received his Bachelor of Science degree in journalism from Ohio University in 1969, where he was a commencement speaker in 1993, and he's received honorary doctorates from Columbia College in Chicago, Lake Forest College, and Nazareth College in Rochester. And our panel is being moderated today by Ryan Grimm. Ryan is a reporter with the soon-to-be-launched Capital Leader, a political insider newspaper here in Washington, D.C., and he's a contributor to Slate.com, where he frequently writes about the issue of drug policy. He's a former Washington City paper writer and has been featured in the books Living a Life of Value and Under the Influence, The Disinformation Guide to Drugs. Before becoming a journalist, he was a staffer with the Marijuana Policy Project, and he's currently writing a book on drugs and drug policy that's due out in the fall of 2008. So I'd like you all to give a very, very warm welcome to our distinguished panelists today on what is undoubtedly an extremely important issue for you all to be hearing about. Thank you all personally very much for being here to discuss this.
About five years ago, I noticed that I couldn't find any LSD anywhere. And out of an intellectual curiosity, I started asking other friends if they had ever seen it anywhere in the last couple years. They noticed that they hadn't either seen it. And about five of us or so kind of made it sort of a passive activity to wherever we went to ask, you know, have you seen any LSD anywhere? About two years later, I was in graduate school and was allowed to take a class outside of my public policy program. I took a journalism class. The professor asked us to write what are called trend stories. My first thought was, well, a lot of people are playing poker. You know, I'll go write about poker. And I thought, why would I want to write about poker? Well, here's a trend. I can't find any LSD. So I went to my, I had a professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Affairs, Peter Reuter, who's one of the top experts in the country on drug policy. I presented him my theory that there was no acid left. And he said, well, what data do you have? You know, what do you have to back that up? And I said, well, I can't find it. And he said, you know, son, I'm sorry about that, but, you know, that's not how we do things in this field. You know, we base our conclusions on survey data, on emergency room reports, on things that you can notice, detect. He said, look, hand me that, it was the Monitoring the Future, it's an annual survey of high school students. He ran his finger across the LSD number and said, as you'll see here, there's been a steady amount of LSD. And then he got to the year 2003 and it had plummeted. He's like, said, that's strange, but it's a deviation. And he explained to me the way that the cycles of drugs go. You know, when a drug is in low supply, that means that the price goes up. Producers have more of an incentive to bring it to the market, and it makes a rebound. Eventually it might get priced out, come back down, it goes up and down. I said, that's how these things work. And I said, I don't know. It's been 3 years. You know, the producers have had a chance to notice that it's gone. He said, okay, the 2004 numbers should be out either now or they're coming out in the next week or so. And if it stays the same, then you've got something here. He showed me where to find the 2004 numbers. They had just come out. I found them online, and it had plummeted another 50%. And when I brought that back to him, his jaw dropped. And he's like, this isn't a trend. This is an event. This has never happened in the history of drug policy. We've never seen a disappearance like this, a sustained disappearance like this. So wrote this story for my class, and the professor said, you know, this is actually something that you should publish somewhere. This is something serious. And so eventually it was suggested that I send it to Slate magazine, and I sent it to their drug policy editor, sort of there, named Jack Schaefer. I hadn't heard of him at the time, but he got his start doing drug reporting, was then editor of the Washington City paper, San Francisco Weekly, has been with Slate for, I think it's since its inception. He read the story and he wrote back. He said, thanks for this. I'm rejecting this, and I'm going to tell you why. I don't want you to take my reasoning why, as a reason to rewrite it, I'm rejecting it outright. And then he explained that reporters have a tendency to look around themselves and notice that something has changed. Their neighbor bought a Prius. And then they write a story that says, you know what, more and more people are buying Priuses. And you'll often see a lead where, you know, Jane Thomas bought a Prius. And then the next paragraph will say, Jane is not alone. And that's yep. That's how you know you're reading a bad article. If you look for that, you'll see it over and over and over again. And then you'll often notice that it's not followed by any facts. So I wrote back to Jack Shaver and I said, I agree with you that, you know, this is a mistake that a lot of journalists write, but I really don't think that there's any LSD out there. And I said, you say you used to be a drug reporter, ask your old sources. And if they found any LSD. And he wrote back the next day and said, can you come down to my office? See, apparently he had called some ex-sources of his out in San Francisco from, and they were in the hate. And one of them was, he was a blotter artist, and that he would make blotter paper. And then he would sell it to museums and, undipped to museums or to art galleries, et cetera. He's been tried a couple times by the federal government, but they haven't been able to put him in prison yet. And he said, yeah, there's no LSD. So they published this story, and to my happiness, nobody wrote to say, and sort of sadness, nobody wrote to say that I was wrong. And the article was read, it went all over the internet, and I got hundreds of emails. Nobody saying that it was wrong, which is interesting because it's hard to prove a negative because all you have to do is find one dose of LSD and there you go. You're wrong. So I tell this story because that incident sent me from where I was headed towards career in policy into a career in journalism. Not the normal way to get started. And because there has been such a vacuum of drug policy coverage in the media, it opened a way for me to move up quickly in the drug policy world. I mean, in the media, even in the mainstream media. And I tell it because I feel like I get a sense from a lot of reporters that they have a fear of doing serious reporting about drugs and drug policy because they're afraid that they won't be taken seriously. And perhaps I'm an anomaly and they're right. Or maybe they're wrong. And so I wanted to ask the panels here who actually have had careers in journalism as opposed to me who's just looking at one possibly in the future. If that is the case and also when you first started doing reporting about drugs, how did your colleagues react to that? Were you looked at as less of a serious journalist? Obviously, anything that came from that has been overcome, but what was it like when you originally started that?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me today. I'm delighted to be here to talk about this topic and get into it. I have to say right off the bat that when we talk about seriousness with the drug issue, I agree the seriousness is important. At the same time, probably the worst sin a journalist can commit outside of being inaccurate, which of course is the number one sin, would be the sin of being dull. So I'm here to defend headlines that use cliches like up in smoke and that risk issue burns me up, et cetera, if only because a little levity doesn't do anybody any harm. And here I go. Coffee, tea, or here we go. And secondly, I love the goodie bag you all gave me, but it's hard for me to keep a totally straight face when I open the goodie bag and I see a bottle of hemp shampoo, and then this wonderful chocolate here in case I get the munchies. So Let's remember the true nature of our topic here. Number two, regard to the press, please rest assured there is no normal way to become a journalist. That's the beauty of journalism. That's the beauty of our First Amendment in this country and the free press and other rights that it guarantees, including the right to print all the blotters you want to as long as you don't dip them in acid. And therefore, you can sell them as museum pieces, et cetera. And the today, it's even better because of the great explosion of media that we have. Slate.com being an example, the Internet, et cetera, has made it possible to do for you to do things we talked about when Bill Press and I were students back in the 1850s, where there was some talk about, you know, talking back to your TV set and everybody being their own journalist and thinking, well, you can do it now. You know, you got the power. And so I preface my remarks by saying that these days when you talk about what the media covers or doesn't cover, it's all out there. It's a matter of access. You know, either reporters accessed information or news consumers having access to the journalism. Now, I want to talk about pathologies of the press. A couple have been mentioned already. One of them is the overuse of cliches and headlines. And another one is what Jack Schaefer talked about, which I've talked about. I've been threatening for years to write a book on pathologies of the press if I ever find the time. But one of the pathologies I noticed early on was the pathology of proximity, that as an old rewrite man mentor of mine told me back in the 1870s, so when I was working the rewrite desk at the Chicago Tribune, Sun News is whatever happens near the news editor's house. And with that one remark, he told me something I hadn't heard in 4 years of university journalism instruction, but it is true. On the flip side is what Jack Schaefer demonstrated to you, which is that editors have an abhorrence of anything that sounds too new. It's like it's too good to be true. You know, this, you walk in there and say, hey, where's all the acid gone? And you say, wait a minute. You know, it just sounds too far out. Who is this kid walking in here? You know, now if you were Bob Woodward, maybe he would have been a little more whatever, you know. Maybe he should, maybe he shouldn't, but he would have, you know. It's that kind of thing happens. There's that resistance then to something that is either too new and too unfamiliar, or something that is too familiar at the same time, you know. So there's always, kind of a crazy paradox. Number three is that we're a daily business, or at least us in the old media, we're a daily business, that we get it out and get the news delivered immediately, and tomorrow is a new day. So whatever either rules, standards, et cetera, you think of for what is news, it's going to change day to day. Now, you in the new media of the Internet, it's news every minute. Everything is new constantly. And it's kind of like sausage making. You just kind of cut it off and tie it up and produce some more. So what happens is I honestly don't know why we have such weird behavior in regard to covering drugs, because it always changes. I don't believe editors are against marijuana legalization or fairness in drug policy, because most editors now are of my generation. They're boomers, came up through the 60s, and whether they're open about their past drug use or quiet about it, like President Bush, nevertheless, we have different attitudes toward it than our parents did. It was our generation that kind of broke things open in the 60s as far as attitudes went. By the 70s, you had so much legalization or decriminalization of marijuana that now there's a false impression. I was just telling this to a normal podcaster here that, there's a false impression widespread in the land that we have a lot less marijuana enforcement and abuse of the law than we actually do have. And I've had two out of three drug czars tell me to my face that nobody gets arrested for marijuana possession anymore. Now these are drug czars. They feel confident. Barry McCaffrey under Clinton. You know, I was asked if I expect a liberalization of policy under Nancy Pelosi, a San Francisco Democrat. And frankly, liberal Democrats are scared to death of appearing to be too liberal on certain issues. And when you get near drugs, they get, it's like there's a scarlet letter about serious debate of the issue. In the media, in our newsroom pathologies, there's a sense a lot of editors have that this is old news. That it's not a story anymore, you know. And that's not true of all drugs. You guys at Slate have done a great job of probing methamphetamine and how methamphetamine has been covered. It's like Reefer Madness all over again, you know. Newsweek and others, where they've covered the meth epidemic versus the reality. At least, you know, Jack Shaver, you've been able to give some kind of balance to the coverage is kind of a preponderance out there in the media. So, like I said, I could go on and on. Let's give Bill Press a chance.
We're listening to audio from the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference last year in Washington, D.C. On this panel are journalists Ryan Grimm, Bill Press, and Clarence Page. The complete panel is available on the Normal Events podcast. We have links at normalaudiostash.com.
I'll pick up there.
Jump right in there.
Hello, everybody. Good to be with you. This is my first introduction to Students for a Sensible Drug Policy. I'm glad to know you exist. I'm glad to know that the work you're doing. I know you've been around 8 years. SSDP, I was thinking driving over. I look forward to when we have an SSEP organization, Students for a Sensible Environmental Policy. We could also have SSWP, Students for a Sensible War Policy, which I'd like to see. And and then how about if we go on to an SSTP, Students for a Sensible Torture Policy, which is like, you know, maybe, get rid of it. In terms of, so good to be with you. In terms of reporters and why they're afraid to touch it, I think for a couple of reasons. I think it comes out of ignorance. I don't think they know the issue. I don't think they take time to find out about the issue. They believe the bullshit that they're fed from politicians or the drug czar. Remember, the war on drugs started in 1971 under Richard Nixon. That ought to tell you something. And we spent billions and billions of dollars since, $20 billion a year now, and what has it gotten us? Nothing. Nothing except a waste of money and filling our prisons, and with people who shouldn't be there. But the reporters don't even want to, they don't, to me the facts are so obvious, but the reporters don't want to go there, and I think one of the reasons they don't want to go there, they not only don't know about it, they don't want to find out about it, is they're afraid if they start reporting on drugs seriously and positively, God forbid, they would hurt their careers. And I also think they're afraid they might reveal something about their own past. And so they just stay away from it. It's like the third rail of the media for many people, like it's the third rail of politicians. How many campaigns we just got through the midterm elections? You know, why wasn't the war on drugs an issue in any campaign around the country? I don't know where it was an issue in any campaign around the country, except in the two states where there were initiatives on the ballot, and to my great dismay, the one in Nevada lost. I thought if anywhere in a state that legalizes prostitution, gambling, and almost anything else you want, that you could get an initiative passed to decriminalize marijuana, but it didn't work there. But again, the issue wasn't talked about in 2006. It wasn't talked about in 2004. It wasn't talked about in 2000, except when somebody said, oh, Al Gore smoked pot once. Oh, wow. I just think that the reporters are afraid of it. In terms of my own reporting, the second part of your question, let me make it clear. I've never been a reporter, and I'm not one now. Okay, so I'm a commentator, which means it's the best job in the world. I get to give my opinion and get paid for it. So I'm not expected to report the facts. I'm expected to give my opinion. But I'm expected to know the facts and to research the facts and to base my opinion on the facts. And so when I started doing talk radio and I started writing a column and I started doing political commentary on television, it happened to be in Los Angeles, one of the things that I looked at was this war on drugs. And I realized that I'm a conservative, not a liberal, because I don't like wasting money, and I don't like government programs that are massive government programs that spend all of our money and waste all of our money and accomplish nothing. And a real conservative... I'm not running for office. I didn't mean... But I realized those were the facts. Now, how did I get that across to my audience, right? It didn't come because I'm... By the way, all right, I lived in the hate. I was there in the summer of love, so you know my background.
If you remember it, you weren't there.
So they weren't going to take it coming from me, a liberal former pothead from San Francisco, but I found the best guy that I got was a judge, a Republican judge from Orange County. Those of you from California here know Orange County is about as far right as you can get. And I brought this judge onto my radio show in KFI in Los Angeles, and he was terrific. What is his name?
Jim Gray.
Jim Gray, thank you. Okay, I guess he's still out there and still making sense. And he just said, as a Republican, as a conservative, this makes no sense because of all the money that's being wasted in law enforcement, in court time, in prison time, in the bailiffs. He went right from A to Z in how this was wasting public resources. And he was very, very effective, and certainly more effective than I could have been. So I guess my first little winding up here on my first little bit of advice would be, in terms of spokespeople for the issue, the media is absolutely essential to getting your message out. It's absolutely essential to our changing our national drug policy, to get away from prohibition, to have a sensible drug policy. You've got to use the media. You've got to cultivate the media. And I think one way to do it is to get people out there on the media who represent mainstream America that people are not going to be afraid of.
What about you, Clarence? How did you start reporting on drugs, and what was the impact that had?
As a police reporter. As a police reporter in Chicago, which is a great place to be a reporter of any kind. I mean, the only city that associates the Feast of St. Valentine with a massacre. As a city of, and the politics reflect that. And it is this interesting thought, should we say prohibition-related crime instead of drug-related crime? You know, that's an interesting thought because it does deliver a message, and we're constantly debating in the business politically loaded terminology. Take the abortion issue. There's no way to report on the abortion issue without using language that's loaded. Do you refer to somebody as being pro-choice or pro-abortion? Anti-choice or anti-abortion. You know, each side wants you to use certain kinds of language. So I just try to be as factual and close to facts as possible. The question of, are you treated seriously if you cover drug issues? Now that I'm a pundit, I spent two decades now as a pundit, a columnist, editorial writer, etc. I've never had that prejudice. I mean, somebody, he just covers drugs. But when I was a rock critic, I'd get that. Well, he only covers rock and roll, And I personally felt like it was the most important music that was happening at that time. Thank you. I mean, gosh, we gotta, heaven knows. Don't judge rock by what's on the radio now. That's all I can tell you. Anyway, okay. I speak, by the way, as someone who interviewed Jerry Garcia in 67 as a student when I was your age, kiddies. But anyway, smoking doobies backstage at the Ohio University Memorial Auditorium, I want to tell you. What a way to impress a date, But in fact, I had the most prejudice when I was a religion editor for about a year at the Chicago Tribune back in the 70s. Maybe people say Clarence is a religion editor, but no, covering drugs, I think people are serious. And let's be serious about one thing. I think most Americans are sensible about drug policy. I think most Americans have a very sensible drug policy in their heads. And when we go to the referenda are reflections of the popular will. And, Bill, you're right. It was disappointing to see that full-out legalization didn't pass. But look at the track record, though. Each one is coming closer and closer to 50% on full legalization we're talking about here, or decriminalization, however you want to use that language, too. But look at medicinal marijuana. put that on a ballot. Almost every case it has passed, except where you've got a some kind of a technical glitch of some kind. And then Hawaii, their legislature legalized medicinal marijuana. You know, the public, I think, is sensible about it in terms of seeing very little reason to keep medicinal marijuana or marijuana illegal for medicinal purposes. When it comes to all-out decriminalization, say, of simple possession, then they start to get squeamish, start to get nervous. I'm a parent now with a 17-year-old who I happily brought to a normal panel discussion a few years ago, and he was one of the most mature people in the room. He's great. He's great as long as he's not in our house. He suddenly reverts, or when he's with his no-count friends. But, you know, it's remarkable. And he's a graduate of – he's a veteran of D.A.R.E. At a school. So he's been exposed to both sides. And I'm proud of the kid. But also as a parent, I get squeamish about the idea of legalization. And I want to think about it some more and talk about it. It's Kurt Schmoke, former mayor of Baltimore. And prosecutor, thank you. On behalf of Kurt Schmoke, who has now been featured on The Wire. For those of you who got the disc set, the latest set has some great interviews with Kurt Schmoke and others about one of the premises of the last season. They took a section of Baltimore on the show. This is fictitious, but they called it Amsterdam, or on the street, Hamsterdam. The cops just decided to legalize drugs in this one part of town here, and marvelously wonderful things happened to the rest of town until the whole thing got exposed. But they based it on Kurt Schmoke, who advocated legalizing cocaine as an alternative to the kind of awfulness that Baltimore and other cities have had. He just verbalized it, and by verbalizing it, he sunk his chances of being mayor of Baltimore again. That's just how politically.
He was reelected twice after that speech.
That's not the way Kurt Schmoke describes it on the disc, anyway. And maybe it was his nightline appearance with Charlie Rangel. I don't know, but it was a but. It's something that politicians are afraid of this issue to even have a serious discussion about it. So it's something that I think in that regard, the public is still hashing over this issue. Politicians, I think, are dragging behind the public as far as the public's sense of a sensible drug policy, which makes it even more important for the media to report it.
I just want to pick up on one thing. You mentioned that, Chris, I was reading on your website that the Zogby poll, 46%, was it, of Americans now support? Clarence was mentioning public support. I was just reading this morning that the Zogby poll that was, or was it Normal that did this? Normal reported a Zogby poll. 46%, I think it showed, of Americans today would support decriminalization, which I thought mm-hmm. was astounding. And you're right, way ahead of the politicians. Just two quick thoughts that came to me while Clarence was talking. One, I want you to know that there is hope. Ethan Nadelman in the back row was a frequent guest on Crossfire when I was doing Crossfire with Pat Buchanan and John Sununu and Bob Novak, the Prince of Darkness. And I remember I was always for the decriminalization or legalization, as far as I'm concerned, and they were always against it. So then when we left Crossfire, and then a couple years later, Pat Buchanan and I had a show on MSNBC, Buchanan and Press, and we were always coming up with debate topics for every day. And I remember one day we were trying to think I said, let's debate medical marijuana, because I remembered Pat's position on it. I was always for it. He was totally against it. No way, no how. And Pat said, no, we can't debate that. I said, why not? Come on, it's a hot issue. It's out there. It's on the ballot in California. And Pat says, because you and I agree on it. And I said, what? And Pat had gone 180 degrees from being totally against it to totally for it. So if Pat Buchanan can change his mind, I just want you to know, there is hope.
Only about two decades behind William F. Buckley.
Right, for example, mm-hmm. and George Shultz and some other conservative leaders. You mentioned language, which I think is something else in dealing with the media that's very important. In my book, Spin This, I went back and looked at what Newt Gingrich had done when he took over the Congress in 1994. And Gingrich actually published a list of words that Republicans should use when they talk about Republicans. Loyal, patriotic, moral, you know, upstanding, all of those good words. And then a list of words, and you've heard them all, that they should use when they're talking about Democrats, right? Traitors, sloppy, lazy, whatever, big spenders, all those kinds of words. Words are, so Gingrich, he was right about one thing. I mean, words are important, and you use them enough, and enough people use them enough, and you get them out in the media through the talk shows and everything, that those impressions stick. And so I, like, when I heard you say, Kristen, you were introducing us, reform of the drug laws, I think that word reform is a real winner. People see that as reform. It's not into the sledgehammer approach. It's just kind of, you know, shaping things up, getting things in better shape. I think fiscal responsibility is a good word, and you talk about that. And you cannot defend the war on drugs from a fiscal responsible point of view. I was on Hardball yesterday with Chris Matthews, for example, and we were talking about the war in Iraq. And Chris, and I knew I was coming today, and I was, so it popped into my head. And Chris was saying, you know, I was just saying, look, this isn't working. There's nothing to do but just recognize and bring the troops home now. And Chris was saying, I've got a better approach that might sell better, which is, and he said this on Hardball yesterday, let's have a cost-benefit analysis of the war in Iraq. And let's just bring the generals in and bring the defense secretary in and say, okay, you've had 3 years. This is what it cost you. What did we get for that money? And now you want another year? All right. How much is it going to cost for one more year of this stupid war in Iraq? And what are we going to get for it? And you know, you do that with every single program. You should, every government program. Let's do it for the war on Iraq. Well, I say, let's apply it to the war on drugs, right? And it'd be over instantaneously. So fiscal responsibility is a good word. And I think decriminalization is a better word.
That was a great panel from last year's Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference in Washington, D.C., featured journalists Ryan Grimm from Politico.com, syndicated columnist and radio host Bill Press, and syndicated columnist Clarence Page. You can download that complete panel on the Normal Events podcast. We have links to it at normalaudio-.com. You can catch some 2007 Normal Conference audio up there. And by the way, folks, again, there's lots of video coming online from the 2007 Normal Conference, and you can buy DVDs. More information about that video and the DVDs from the Normal Conference are available up on our website. We've got direct links right at normalaudio-.com. Later on this week, we're going to speak with Richard Lee and Danielle, the Chancellor and President of Oaksterdam University. They're going to tell us about their course curriculum that is training people to work in California's cannabis industry. Very interesting stuff. That'll be later this week, right here on Your Audio Stash. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.